Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
Hello everybody, my name is John Bleasdale, I'm a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be doing something a little bit unusual because I don't have a guest for this week, and I'm heading out to a film festival in Norway. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to propose the first ever episode of Writers on Film. This is an episode in which I talked to Tom Schoen, so I really started with one of the big hitters. He has written many a book, including blockbusters. He's done a retrospective of Martin Scorsese, and his book that we were talking about mainly, although we talked about everything from Tarantino, blockbusters, we talked about everything, it was a book on Christopher Nolan that had just come out, and I had just read the Nolan Variations. So it's a little bit cheeky because obviously you could have read, you could have listened to this at any time, but rather than leaving a gap, I wanted to leave you with something. And if you've already listened to it, it'll give you an opportunity to revisit. And if you haven't listened to it, it'll give you an opportunity to discover. You can hear me in all the freshness of my first ever podcast when I wasn't quite sure what I was doing. So yeah, there's that to enjoy. Thanks to Elliot Atkins for the music and to Ali Harwood for the artwork, and thanks to you, listener. I will see you with a new guest next week, but before that, enjoy the conversation.
Yeah, really, and I'm a huge fan of just reading film books.
Oh, good. You're the one.
Well, I think for me, I grew up in like the 70s and 80s in the northwest of England. Cinema was like miles away. You know, books were like my entry drug to cinema because I would be reading about books. I'd be reading about movies.
Yeah.
I had practically no chance of seeing.
So
that's what I thought. Oh, was that similar with you?
I mean, I don't remember having kind of too many problems with access. I mean, I do remember having to wait a long time for the movies I wanted to see, you know, because nothing would go to DVD and nothing would go to video because that wasn't around. So if you missed it, it was it, you know, like that's, you know, so yeah, I think that's probably true. Like we had to recreate the experience in other forms, whether it be comics, I remember, or later books. But I hadn't really thought about that. That's a really good point that, like, and it could explain why kind of, I mean, film books are actually quite a difficult thing to crack these days. And I think you've just hit the reason why, which is, you know, people have so many options, don't they, in terms of DVD extras and so on, if they want to delve.
My first ever cinema experience was Star Wars in the winter of 77.
Sure.
And it was shown on ITV, I think, in 1982.
Is that right? God, wow.
So it's like 5 years. So I saw it when I was five.
Yeah.
And then again when I was 10. You know, I mean, that's like you're a different person, you know.
Yeah, yeah. That's funny.
How did you start? Because I know you were a film critic for the Sunday Times for a period. Was it a big step or was it a natural evolution or how did it work?
Like a lot of kind of good things, I was kind of forced into it in a state of absolute desperation and anxiety. Like the, I mean, I really only turned to books because journalism turned out to be such a sort of rickety boat. I mean, I came out to New York to work for a magazine called Talk Magazine, which was run by Tina Brown. And when that magazine probably folded about 2 years after I'd moved. And so I definitely had the sense of jumping out of the sort of Titanic and into the sea. And in that environment that I was in at that time, it was actually made more sense for me to try and pitch a book idea than it did to sort of penetrate American journalism. I had very few contacts, but I did have contacts in sort of publishing. So that's kind of what forced me to, I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't had that kind of that capsizing moment with, with magazines going under in the early 2000s and finding, you know, I really needed like a sort of lifeboat. So that was kind of really how I ended up doing the first book that I did, which is weird that it would turn out to be more a safer environment than journalism.
What about in terms of you approaching film and writing? How did you initially get into that even prior to the first book?
Let me see. I mean, I kind of wrote my first film review when I was at university. I think it was a Robin Williams movie, Good Morning Vietnam. And then when I left, I started writing for like a small startup magazine that, you know, called The Modern Review, which was sort of all about popular culture that Julie Birchall ran. And that was had a very small, it was like a, you know, small magazine that was made for peanuts. And, but it sort of happened to catch the attention of Fleet Street at that time. And, you know, editors got very interested in it. So it was a good sort of platform. And so then it was from there to the Sunday Times. And then I think I'd started reviewing movies for them in 96. I mean, it was sort of a different era then. I mean, the internet was barely up and running. I mean, it was, but I think I remember, you know, the first time that you kind of sent your copy down the internet, there's a strange kind of dial-up kind of, you know, connection that you had in those days. And
you had to turn the handle to get it.
And what I didn't really know was that the journalism at that point, I mean, it really just seemed like it did seem like remarkably easy to make a living. I mean, I can remember leaving university and thinking, the outside world seems like a very scary place and I'm not sure I'm going to find somewhere to employ me. And I was like pleasantly surprised by the sort of speed and ease with which it happened. And I sort of thought that meant that I was extremely talented. And now looking back, I actually realized it's not that at all. What it was journalism was in a state of kind of engorgement. Like it was about as big as it was ever going to be. And it was heading for the edge of a cliff. So it had lots of sort of money. You know, I remember editors were sort of driving around in kind of Golf GTIs and it was, you know, but it was heading for the edge of the cliff because the internet was just about to sort of take out its knees. So we had no idea. So that's really what it was. And in those days, there were so many newspapers, so many Sunday newspapers that had to fill so many pages. So it was a sort of small one. It was sort of almost more difficult not to end up there than not. It was much easier in retrospect than I realized. So, you know, that's how it worked. I mean, and then it was very different when the internet came along, of course, you know, sort of a sort of different environment. And, you know, everyone's a critic and so on and so forth. So it definitely was like a kind of it was like last days of Versailles or something.
or the first class cabin on the Titanic.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's funny as well, things have changed. Because I was reading a comment that on your website, a review of one of your books, and it was Clive James. And he said this really lovely thing. Most critics are at their best when speaking the language of derision, but Schoen has the precious gift of being carried away in a sensible manner and of being celebratory without setting your teeth on edge. I'm not sure being carried away in a sensible manner sounds absolutely sort of paradoxical. But I love this idea that the word fan with the idea of fandom feels to me like a really poisonous thing at the moment. And the idea of critic seems to have an automatic negativity, but like the celebrant is a nice idea that you can write about something positively. Is that something that, you know, does that just come from your love of movies and your wish to communicate? How are you so positive?
I mean, honestly, I think it was going through the kind of capsizing Titanic situation, to tell the truth, because if you're going to write a sort of longer form book about something, it doesn't work if you're coming from an angle of wanting to take something down. Like a book I've found can only really come from a place of enthusiasm. So it was really that. And certainly there's a kind of culture of writing about film for the newspapers, or at least there was in the 80s and 90s. And I think Clive James is like one of the kind of great masters of that form, which sort of encouraged, you know, a sort of sharpness of wit. And you kind of read the newspaper often in order to see this kind of great critic, be it kind of Clive James or A.A. Gill, kind of sharpen his knives and take some big ego down to size, you know. And that was that's the whole point. And it's something that newspapers encourage, and it's good, and we used to anyway. But it's not so good when it comes to writing a book. It didn't get me any very far anyway, let's put it that way. So I think one of the things that I kind of discovered coming out to America and having journalism capsize and sort of casting around for things to kind of write about is that you just go back to your enthusiasms. And for me, at least, the first book I wrote was kind of about the, you know, blockbuster, summer blockbuster. And so that was literally just going back to when I was 7 or 8 and seeing Star Wars for the first time and trying to kind of recapture that enthusiasm. So it was there was an autobiographical element.
There's a real sort of nostalgia about that period from a lot of people who weren't actually there at the time. But I go back to those blockbusters that you mentioned in your book. I mean, Jaws and Jaws I saw on the television, but Star Wars and Ghostbusters. I remember Ghostbusters being at a screening in Barrow-in-Furness that was absolutely packed, and people were dancing. It was like, you know, it was like somebody had told me about the Blackboard Jungle and, you know, people dancing to Rock Around the Clock during the title sequence. It was the same sort of energy, you know, which I've felt precious few times since, not in my life generally, I mean, in a cinema.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that those kind of early blockbusters really brought home to you, was a sense of your fellow audience members. And, you know, the audiences got really noisy again. And I know that's kind of can sometimes be an issue for some people. American audiences are very noisy. But yeah, like Spielberg sort of talks about, you know, going past the cinema and being able to, that was playing Jaws, and being able to work out where they were in the movie by the sort of noise that they were making, the size of the screen that they were making. And the same thing with Star Wars. I mean, people just came out of that movie just jubilant, you know, like popcorn was going through the air. And like, there was this sense in which what we found like in those years was like a sense of togetherness as an audience. Like in the 70s, I was trying to remember, like, large crowds generally didn't really signify anything very good. Like if you were in a large crowd in the 70s, it probably meant you're either unemployed and in a queue to get unemployment benefit, or maybe you were protesting the Vietnam War, or you were, you know, it generally, we didn't come together for kind of good things. We came together for kind of bad. But then suddenly we could all come together and kind of watch these movies en masse. And there was a sort of real thrill of like being part of a jubilant mass. I'm sure, you know, sort of football has the same sort of thing, you know, but it's like, but again, you know, with football, I mean, I think that kind of turned, that there was a, that turned a corner too, didn't it, where the sort of the violence dropped away during the same period. So yeah, it was definitely, there was a, and I think that's the thing that, you know, I definitely have missed. I mean, I, you know, it's like I still love sort of, you know, it's definitely a really exciting thing to be part of an audience. All those guys too, all those people that make those films, like Nolan and Spielberg, and they all sort of like to sneak into the cinema and see how they're going down. And I can totally understand that, because the temperature inside a movie theatre where their film is playing is a really interesting, it's a really interesting thing.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Unless you've made a complete turkey.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, exactly. And you can kind of go and find out things about your film, because I think when a film like meets its audience, it changes slightly, like it becomes a different creature and things about it are revealed, you know, like the famous example being they didn't know that you're going to need a bigger boat was a big laugh line. And they didn't realize that was a joke until it met the audience. And then suddenly they laughed to relieve the tension of the previous scene. And then boom, they had a moment. So they, and it's funny, like how many of those films, like I'll Be Back as well in the Terminator movies, they didn't know that was going to be a big line, and then it met the audience and the audience made it a line, you know. So there's this definitely kind of interactive quality with the audiences and those big movies. They kind of make them different films sometimes.
Absolutely. There's so many films as well that I've gone to see completely cold, and the energy of the dawning realization as you're in the movie theater, hang on a minute, I'm watching a masterpiece right now. I mean, you sort of went after blockbusters, you went and sort of started choosing people to sort of do retrospectives on and do sort of single filmmaker studies. How did you, were those like commercial considerations, this will sell, are these the names of your sort of pantheon of filmmakers?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to remember, actually. I mean, I hadn't really thought about it. I mean, one of the things that happened in publishing, film publishing sort of changed a little, and those coffee table books, I remember in the sort of first decade or second decade, like they began to become slightly more, the more interesting things. I can remember when they were kind of looked down on a little, because it was mostly sort of pictures, and the text that went with them was often very, you know, adulatory. And there's a difference, you know, between, you can celebrate, but I think there was something a little bit, you know, when I can remember when I sort of read them, they were just a little too sort of hagiographic, you know. It was like all the kind of bad, you know, the bad movies a film director had made were kind of, you could barely tell from reading these things, you know. It was just all about the kind of the awards that they collected, and you're like, oh, okay. So, but then I think that started to change, and I honestly, I think that the one that caught my eye was the Wes Anderson book by, I never know how to pronounce his name, but Matt Zoller-Zeitz, who's this kind of very good American critic. And he really pulled out all the stops on that Wes Anderson book. I mean, he had the collaboration of Anderson, which helped, but it looked great, but the text was also great. And so they suddenly became a little bit more attractive to do. And as sort of people tried to work out what kind of books people wanted to read, they became a more attractive option. So in those cases, you're often, because they're so picture heavy, you're definitely heading for the kind of the real, you know, household names. That's the maybe the one limiting thing about that bit of the market, is because they're expensive to produce, you know. You really are kind of looking at kind of, you know, Woody Allen and Clint Eastwood and all the kind of those sort of big names. And so maybe that's the sort of the limitation a little bit, is kind of, you know, would they want to do Fincher? I mean, you would hope that they want to do someone like Fincher, but I can imagine that also being a kind of, you know, weirdly a bit of an uphill, you know, struggle, you know, pitching that, because I think as a genre, they really like the actor directors, because then you've got the kind of the fame of the acting career too. But, you know, but yeah, I mean, obviously Scorsese and, you know, and Tarantino, they're sort of big auteur brand names. So they worked for them too.
When you choose a filmmaker like that, does it change the way you look at them after you've written the book? I mean, you must be watching the films multiple times with a sort of intensity that might be, you might not have done in the past. Has it changed your view of any of those filmmakers in a way that, you know, drastically, or?
Yeah, I mean, not sort of, I wouldn't say sort of drastically, but that's such a good question. I mean, I sort of think, I would say that the book that happened on was the book I did about Scorsese, and it wasn't like I had any great sort of Damascene flash, but I mean, you do get very kind of keyed to the sort of sequence of careers and the sort of story of careers. And so you do have, like, that kind of gives you some insight. And it became apparent to me when I sort of did the Scorsese book that the story of, like, his career in the 70s, which is basically he goes out to work for the studios in the early 70s, rides this kind of extraordinary wave of sort of success, critical success, and awards and so on. And then as that era begins to kind of crash and burn at the end, so does he with New York, New York. And he moves back to New York at the end of that period. I think it was like just before he made Raging Bull. And it hadn't occurred to me like just how important a kind of almost a physiological act, that thing that was in kind of Scorsese's career, like the experience of being, of riding high and then gradually it sort of slipping away and then this kind of, you know, cataclysmic kind of coming down to earth. And it sort of, as I looked again and again at that story, I was like, oh, that's Goodfellas. That's the story of Goodfellas. That's what he, that's, you know, that's the story he was telling when he made, when he came to make Goodfellas. You know, oh my God, we had it good and boy, did we blow it. Like that's the, you know, and I was like, and then you think, oh, okay. So that's, that was kind of burned into his psyche. You know, like that experience of success and then crumbling, like that, you know, marked him and it gave him a subject. And so that was interesting, like kind of figuring out that like when he was making Goodfellas, he was more or less kind of telling us the story of his 70s, you know, like complete with Rolling Stones soundtrack. And, you know, Rolling Stones are not a kind of necessarily all that listened to by the mafia, but they were by him,
yeah.
You know, when he was in Hollywood. So, you know, it was that, so that was that kind of stuff kind of comes out when you look at the sort of sequence of the careers. I mean, I did later sort of test this theory on him and he was, there was something there. He didn't kind of go, absolutely, that's what I was explicitly doing, but he was like, oh yeah, maybe.
And that sort of, you know, in a sense sort of becomes, there's a bit of that DNA in almost all of those later films as well. I mean, The Aviator and the, you know.
Yep.
I mean, what I loved about that book is that you, I don't know if you, rescue might be too dramatic a word, but you appreciated Color of Money. And that's one of my favorite Scorsese movies. I just think that film is so underrated.
Yeah. If that movie had had the money to have a Rolling Stones soundtrack to buy, it would, I think, be remembered a little bit differently. And that's not just to knock the soundtrack it has, which is great, but I kind of feel like that's the one thing missing from that film that would lift it into the a different zone. Because it's otherwise, I think, perfect. Like that's the film where he really did manage to kind of completely, after the kind of crash, you know, when you look at Color of Money, you're seeing somebody who has completely reconstituted themselves. It's like the Bionic Man, you know, we can rebuild him. And he's totally learned how to make a low budget movie independently. And it, you know, it's amazing. Those movies that he made in the 80s are almost like the template for like what the independent film movement would do. And you look at The Color of Money and think, oh, that's exactly the template that Darren Aronofsky would use later on when he would get like, you know, Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler. You know, you find an older star, you kind of build a kind of character piece sort of around that star, and you kind of finance the movie that way, but you keep, you know, the cost low. That's exactly what so many independent filmmakers did. And I think like, you know, Scorsese in the 80s was basically laying out all these kind of these clues to like the what the indies would do. Like if you look at like what's it, After Hours, and you think, oh, that's like that's the Coens, he's making, yeah, a Coens movie. They would take that template and not consciously, but that so that's what kind of it. Definitely the 80s, in a weird kind of way, people don't look at the Scorsese's 80s as being this kind of great, glorious time, but in many ways, it sort of shows you what a great director he is, because he's absolutely at his sort of most desperate stretch in that period where he's trying to kind of keep a grip on the filmmaking career. He's trying to stay in the game and he's really kind of rebuilding from scratch. And it's like so fascinating that he kind of came out so strong. I mean, amazing, really.
Yeah, it's such a roller coaster of a career, that. And the other, there was something that you wrote that I also appreciated. I've always thought Casino was the better film to Goodfellas. And I was reading your book yesterday as to prepare for the interview, and your argument about Casino, it struck me, I don't think you put it quite like this, but this is what sort of came into my head, was The reason I think Casino is a better film is because I enjoy Goodfellas more. You know, and whereas Casino, I feel like drained at the end of it and sort of hollowed out. And so the Catholic in me thinks that must be a better experience. That must be a more moral experience. You
know? That's such an interesting reaction. I mean, that's all of us have felt that to some degree or another. Like, I'm enjoying this film too much for it to be a classic.
Yeah.
You know, I definitely, yeah. I mean, I think Goodfellas is definitely his sort of most enjoyable film. And the thing that differentiates for me, like Goodfellas and Casino, is the element of the boyhood, you know, and the fact that he kind of goes, there's a sort of the warmth in it. And it, I'm not saying this is better or worse, but the warmth of Goodfellas and the with which he views as a boy those characters. And, you know, that's very much like Scorsese's own sort of admiration for those neighborhood hoodlums that he kind of looked up to. And, you know, like, it's there's an element of autobiography in it, a slim one, about his boyhood anyway, that kind of warms that film up. And it's sort of, and you sort of almost forget that, like, it's probably as a result, I mean, it is a sort of form of fantasy. There is a sort of fantasy in there, and the fantasy is because he was a sort of weakly asthmatic kid who wasn't really at all tough, I mean, on the street. And there's this sort of dream of kind of being accepted by much more violent men and accepted into their ranks. And I think it's one that obviously a lot of people, myself included, share. Yeah. There's like that's the sort of fantasy that's being sold in Goodfellas. And that's maybe why it's his most, I mean, people really love Goodfellas for that reason. I mean, Casino, I think, is cold. It's a kind of colder film. I mean, listen, it's technically fantastic. I mean, I can see he's really, I sort of felt, you know, each time he remakes that film, and he's sort of remade it several times now in a way, Wolf of Wall Street being the most recent, I sort of feel like with each time he almost gets better at making that film, but maybe with less urgent reason for being. Like, it doesn't sort of feel as you know, sort of great films can really just feel plucked into existence. They had to exist, you know.
Yeah.
And then the weaker ones feel that they were sort of pushed into existence and they were made to exist, you know. And, you know, but then I also love Wolf of Wall Street, so I'm not saying it's not, you know, it doesn't have a reason for being. But he also gets more and more amoral as it goes on. Like, the cackle gets louder and louder, you know.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I think that's a great argument for looking at him as a retrospective, looking at him as a whole filmmaker, because I wonder what Casino would be like if Goodfellas just didn't exist. Because it's almost, the two almost have to go together. Otherwise, you're right that it's just so cold and horrific.
Yeah, I mean, I often play that game a little differently, and I sometimes think, like, you know, when I often think when directors go off, and I'm not including Scorsese in this, but when they kind of lose whatever it is they had at the beginning of their career, I often think, what would happen if this were their first movie? Like, so I remember when I wasn't as sold on Kill Bill as some people were. And I kind of remember thinking, I wonder what would happen if this were his first film, not Reservoir Dogs. Would Tarantino be as revered as he is today? Or what about Inglourious Basterds? Maybe that's a better one to use. If Inglourious Basterds were his first film, what would we be saying about this guy? You know, like, and I do think that there's this element of, like, when they first, there's a reason why those first films are often, like, in a way, like the really, you know, the really perfect ones. I'm not saying that they don't produce masterpieces later on, but, and it's because they haven't won us over yet. And they're sort of like this sort of very ardent suitor, you know, they're trying to seduce the audience and they're sort of putting every effort into it, and like they're just fantastic Romeos, and then later on they have us, and then we fall into the relationship falls into neglect, and they become a little lazier and they don't care for us so much, and
like, no more breakfast in bed for you.
Yeah. It's something like that a little bit, you know, like, and they begin to take us for granted, and, you know, and I you don't treat me the way you used to, and you kind of get into these conversations. But there's an element of that. I think there's nothing like a young director who's trying to prove himself for the audience for the first time. Like, they're kind of on fire, you know.
I had a bit of a falling out with Tarantino. I mean, I always liked his later stuff, but I didn't love it the way I loved Reservoir Dogs. I loved Pulp Fiction. I liked and admired Jackie Brown, but I always feel it's a little bit the I don't quite trust people who say they love it as much as that, because it doesn't have that appeal to me. It feels like an Elmore Leonard novel, to tell you the truth. And those ones that you just mentioned, not Django, Inglourious Basterds and Kill Bill, they always felt to me like they were like essays on, they were like pastiche essays on a better movie, perhaps, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's sort of, it's not really spoken about enough, just how much he was doing something very, very different in those films. Like in the first films that he made, what he was doing was dropping some kind of very movie-ish situation, like a heist or an overdose or whatever it was. He was kind of dropping that into the laps of characters who were just like everyday, you know, sort of dope smoking, video watching kind of slobs, and watching how they would react and making sure that their reaction was as realistic as possible. He was basically taking a movie situation and dropping it into the laps of his fellow video clerks, you know, and sort of seeing like, how would they react? And I sort of think so, and there was this amazing clash between the movie-ishness of the idea and then the realism of the reaction, which is often to do with the way they spoke.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
And he managed to get the way that people spoke absolutely perfect. Like his grasp of kind of street slang and idiom was where the realism sort of came from, you know. And I thought, and with Kill Bill on, he changed his MO. He was playing a very different game. He was no longer trying to take movie-ish kind of plot situations and dropping them into the lap of kind of like the guy next to you in the cinema. He was taking movie situations and sort of dealing with them in a kind of movie-ish way. We were totally in the movie universe. Like there was no attempt to kind of anchor it or get comedy from contrasting it with the sort of the slang of everyday life. And you noticed, I really noticed it in the way that everybody suddenly started speaking in this extremely ornate way. Everybody suddenly sounds like a fop, an 18th century fop, like discoursing for like four paragraphs, you know, and you're like, wow, what happened to the guy that was writing such sort of street smart dialogue? He's just gone, you know. So I felt a great disappointment with almost all of them from Kill Bill on. I mean, I know some people are totally not, don't see it that way, but I just see him as just doing a different thing. It's not like he's not as good at the game. It's more like he's just playing a different game. It's not even, I think there's a line in Pulp Fiction, it's not even the same ballpark, it's not the same sport. You know, like, yeah. He's just, it's a different sport. So that was my disappointment with his career. And here and there, he kind of gets it back. There are little moments of Django, there are little moments of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where something of the old, you know, heat sort of comes back into his writing.
I'm
afraid that I do see the early ones as very much the best ones. I mean, I think that kind of Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs are so head and shoulders above everything else that like it's not even funny. Like they're just, he hasn't unfortunately kind of matched those.
Yeah, it's almost like directors sometimes need the anti. I remember a friend of mine, I don't claim credit for this idea, but a friend of mine telling me that Wes Anderson always needs an anti-Wes Anderson inside his movie for it to be any good. So, you know, the reason Royal Tenenbaums is great is Gene Hackman is not Wes Anderson. He's the kind of guy who would slap Wes Anderson. And Rushmore, it's Bill Murray. But when you get to Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou and when you get to the Darjeeling Limited, there's no anti-Wes Anderson. It's like everybody's a version of Wes Anderson.
That's very funny. I mean, he was actually there's great stories about like him being terrified of Gene Hackman on the set and having to have Bill Murray act as like an intermediary, you know, because he was so frightened of him. But I think that's very true. I think, you know, like the great, and is, you know, directors at the beginning of their career have to tolerate large amounts of opposition and collaboration with people who aren't exactly like them, and you know, and then as their career, the more successful they get, the less they have to do that, which is unfortunate, you know, that's the unfortunate thing. And so some of the resistance and the friction goes out. I think that's true of all, in every department, not just necessarily in the actors and the casting, but sort of, you know, the finance people, and you know, everything gets a little bit easier, and they it's harder to find that you know, that sense of kind of having to go out and persuade. And I mean, it helps maybe if you're a little bit self-destructive, like Scorsese, because then you really do have to go out and recreate the whole thing over and over again. You know, that's actually, in many ways, like a great career move, is to sort of just fail big time, you know, and then have to kind of come back from that. I mean, all of the big ones have got like something like that, some big film where they sort of stub their toe and they come down and then they have to rebuild. And often it's their best films then proceed, you know, like I always think of Spielberg and like after 1941 and then he comes out with Raiders and E.T. and they're direct results of having kind of blown it so big on 1941.
Which is such a weird film. I mean, I rewatched that recently and I think he said himself, I should have just made a musical. You know, it's just not got the songs.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, and there's very, of course, like all these things, they're great to go back to and find. I mean, it's beautiful. It's very intricate. And some of the numbers are sequences are fantastic. And so much ingenuity in it. I mean, but Spielberg is definitely one of those guys who has like a zillion ideas in every kind of meeting. And not every one of them is great. You know, like it's all of these, you know, sometimes they're lunatic, you know, and they need people to keep them in check. And I think he had it was Zemeckis, wasn't it? And Bob Gale and John Milius, and they're all sort of, they're cut from the same cloth. They're all egging each other on, you know, but yeah, I mean, I totally agree. Like movies have to have like a spanner in the works, you know, sometimes to really, really work. I mean, I always think of like Apocalypse Now and the way that like John Milius really kind of screws with the overall scheme because he's so pro-war. And like Coppola thought he was making this anti-war movie, and John Milius, who kind of wrote the script, was like totally for Vietnam. He thought it was a great idea. And so as a consequence, you get these kind of amazing sequences of these clashes. You get the sort of bombing sequence followed by Duval sort of inhaling the napalm and saying how great it is. You know, now that's what people remember. And so you're right, it's totally, you have to have the anti Coppola in there to make a kind of great, you know, great film.
Do you think that moving on to your latest book, the Christopher Nolan, the Nolan variations, and how you didn't call it the Nolan Twisters is beyond me. I assume that title was already taken.
Yeah, no, I sort of went for variations in the end because of the Enigma variations and how much he, you know, liked the Elgar and used it in Dunkirk. And then it got me, because Elgar was a kind of big cryptologist, like he loved kind of mysteries and sort of enigmas and sort of puzzles, just like Nolan did and I does. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I went in the end.
but now you're regretting the Nolan Twisters, aren't you? You're thinking...
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, that should have been it.
I mean, tell you the truth, one of the things I loved about that book, and this is my last compliment because I don't want to come over too celebratory either, but in a sensible manner. I don't want to get carried away in a sensible manner. There was so much in the book which I would stop and put the book down and just think about, because which was beyond the movies, which were things like the left or right. How do you describe left or right to somebody without, you know, referring to, you know, just, you know, you can say up and down, front and back, but you can't say left
over
or right.
Over the phone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Some of those ideas were extraordinary. And I love, it was sort of became much more of a conversation, I felt, that book. You were, there was quite a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad, because definitely that was the, you know, the sort of challenge with that book was to, you know, I was only going to be talking to him. So the rules of the book were no collaborators, no secondary interviews, just him, you know, but I didn't want it to be kind of exactly Q&A, you know, like kind of just transcription of the conversation. And he didn't want it to be a biography. So it had to sort of find its way in the middle and work out what it was. And I was greatly helped by the fact that he kind of kept on challenging me with these, you know, puzzles, or I didn't even really thought of them as challenging me, but he would say these things and they had this kind of, he's got this very sort of semi-scientific cast of mind. Like, he likes testing things, he likes experiments and things. And so he would sort of say these very broad generalities. And I just, like you, I kind of came away from the conversations thinking, is that true? You know, so he would sort of say, yeah, you can't describe left and right down the phone to someone now. And I was like, oh, hang on, you've got to be able to do that. So I kind of, I sort of would come back with an answer as I thought would work. And then he would sort of throw it out. So then it became a little bit like kind of going to the headmaster or something. You go with him with the answer to the test, and then he would sort of mark the test. And then, you know, so there was a kind of quality, there was an interaction between us. And the reason I kept them in is because I thought, well, doesn't that really resemble the way that he deals with his audience too? Because, you know, he sets the puzzle and then the audience are like, try to sort of outwit him a little, you know, and it's like, oh, no, but he's got the twist, you know, but he didn't see the twist. So there's this constant game of chess going on between the audience and him. And so because my conversations with him sort of seemed to play out in that way, I kind of thought, well, I'll keep them in then, because I'll put that in, because that'll get the flavor of the films a little bit. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't have done it, because it might have seemed a little bit sort of weird and self-indulgent. But you know, yeah, like it definitely felt like you were kind of like, I was living a Nolan film. And I thought, oh, okay, that's the way to do it. That's good to put in then. But yeah, he was very competitive too. I would sort of come up with things and I would say, I mean, I thought I'd solved it at least three times. And he would say, no, because of X. And I would go, I really thought that in some instances that the test kept on changing, you know, like I thought I had solved it. And then he would say, yeah, but you didn't do it and also do this. And then I thought, well, you're changing the test a little bit. Okay. But okay. All right. I'll try and solve it again. And, you know, and then at the end, I really think I thought I had, and then it solved it. And then literally the last time almost that we met, as I was heading out the door, literally as I was heading out the door, he said, oh, about that solution. And then he just demolished my answer. And I literally did. I looked at him and I thought, I hate you right now, because this, you've totally, like, how much do you want to win this? Because I really thought I had solved it. I was very resentful at him for like kind of demolishing the answer. And like, but that was why, again, I kind of kept it in. I was like, well, isn't that kind of, that's just a good ending for the book, you know, because like that's often how the films end too, you know, with just coming out the cinema, just kind of going, God, what happened?
Yeah. He's the perfect filmmaker for the sort of like before dinner movie, because you can spend the rest of the evening, you know, picking over the movie. What I mean, in relationship to what we were saying earlier about people like not Martin Scorsese, Quentin Tarantino, and people getting maybe not having the amount of resistance that they need to create truly great stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, another one I would throw into the ring here would be maybe Terrence Malick, you know, whose mm-hmm. films get progressively worse the more editors he has. You know, he starts off with one editor, then there's two, and then by the time his recent films are like three or four editors. What about him? Because I mean, Nolan doesn't really have a spanner in the works. He can kind of, maybe is Tenet his moment where he's going to have to back off and rethink?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, when we were talking about Tenet you know, the immediate comparison piece for me was Inception because but here's the difference is that Inception took him genuinely 20 years to write. Like, he first came up with that story at school and then he kind of rewrote it at various points through his career and tinkered and then finally kind of got it greenlit. But even then, Leonardo DiCaprio had kind of problems with it, and he wanted something a little bit more emotional about the character in it, and he pushed Nolan to rewrite as he was scouting for locations for the film. So as they're sort of trundling towards production beginning, he's still rewriting the film, and there DiCaprio is the spanner in the works because he's saying this film is too complicated and I need my character to have more of an emotional stake in it. So at his behest, that's why Inception becomes the film it does. With Tenet, I don't think that happened. I don't think that there was, it certainly wasn't so long in the writing of it. And I don't think there was any pushback from sort of the actors. I don't think any of them would have really, it was a different relationship as I understand it than the DiCaprio one. And as to whether he's going to have a rethink, I would actually imagine that yes. I mean, as much as when you talk to him about it, you know, he will say, you know, he'll defend his film, right? And he won't really give an inch. He never admits mistakes, and he's not going to start now. But I also know that, you know, he listens to the audience, listens to audiences, and is too much of a kind of an appreciator of kind of mass entertainment not to take seriously that a lot of people were kind of very confused by that film. And I think my guess is that yes, there'll be a readjustment. That's my kind of just feeling, sort of on what I don't know him very well, but that's the sense that I would get. But it's curious, isn't it, as to whether it's exactly his Waterloo moment or not, because it came out during this very strange year, and it's, you know, and the box office is so hard in this particular instance to interpret, because it did fantastically well in some areas like the UK, but in America it did not do well. So the whole question of like judging whether that film was a hit or whether it was not is really an imponderable mystery. And I don't think we'll ever really know. We'll never really be able to say this film was accepted by audiences or it was not, because of the weirdness of the year in which it was released. So in that sense, he sort of dodged a bullet. I mean, I don't think in that sense it won't be as kind of as much of a revealing, you know, reaction as it might have been. But yeah, I have to think that, like, you know, he was hearing it from a lot of people that it was confusing.
Yeah, I guess I see what you mean by dodge the bullet, in the sense that, you know, there's just so many other factors at play. It's hard. But yeah. I mean, I'm a big celebrant, I won't say fan, of Nolan. I like him a lot. I love The Prestige. I think that's probably one of my favorites of his movies. And there is a sort of temptation, looking at the more grandiose movies he's made recently, to sort of, you know, want him to go back and do one of the early funny ones, you know?
Totally. Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think, like, The Prestige is the model too. There's too much action, I think, in some of them. I think rather action cinema, which is a sort of that's the Hollywood genre, you know, that's the thing that he learnt. And from Insomnia, Batman Begins, Dark Knight, well, you can see him mastering sort of all the elements of the kind of, you know, the Hollywood sort of toolkit, as it were. But I think there's too much action in Tenet, to be honest. I could easily see that as a smaller film, and maybe it should have been a smaller film and more intimate sense of sort of betrayal and so on. But it, you know, but I agree. I think that the things need to be scaled down a little, and I think The Prestige is definitely the model. You know, it's an extraordinary. It's such a great film, and it's so, they labored on that screenplay. It's like a kind of, it's beautiful. It's such a great art object, you know, like it's a piece of craftsmanship, that screenplay.
I mean, I've watched that film 100 times. Well, not 100 times, that's ridiculous, but I've watched the film probably in the double figures, and I watched it last week recently, and it was the first time I realized that Hugh Jackman's character was English, and that his American, right, him acting American was the whole, that was his act. So when they go and see the Chinaman and they say him pretending to be, that's this is where the trick happens. Hugh Jackman looks like he's the naive one saying, no, nobody could do that. But he's been doing it all along anyway, because he is Lord so-and-so and has always been Lord that's so-and-so.
That's interesting.
And that's the first time I realized it. And I've seen it hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And when he goes to America, Christian Bale writes in the diary he's given him, you know, maybe you'll stay in America, maybe you'll stay in your homeland. So it's actually not a bad strategy. You've got him out of England. Why bother coming back to England? You've got nothing. But of course, it's not his homeland. His homeland is England. So it's just got these tendrils that go everywhere.
Mm. That's interesting. I hadn't sort of, you picked up on something I hadn't kind of considered, that, you know, you've got the England-America contrast and clash that was in fact so much a kind of part of his kind of growing up. And I hadn't sort of thought about it in those terms, but it's there. And it shows you that there's, you know, when those films really work, there's just layers and layers and layers to them, you know. And that's the thing that I definitely respond to in his work, is the sense in which, you're entering into a world, and that world is sort of defined really by just the sort of the feeling that these layers go on forever, you know, that you can't reach the body. At the end of the Truman Show, he bumps up against the edge of his world. You know, you definitely don't get that in a Nolan film when they're working. You always feel like that world is just kind of infinite. And that's the sort of thrill of them. You know, they're sort of these magic boxes, you know, like they last a certain amount of time. They're contained in sort of time and space, but you enter into them and you kind of feel that you could spend your entire life in it, whereas some people do, you know, they love them so much. I mean, but it's definitely born of his obsession. Like people get obsessed about his films because he's obsessed with them. Like, you know, there's definitely a self-fulfilling kind of quality. Sometimes the audience sort of, if a film is loved by its creator, you know, it'll be loved by the audience. If it's kind of, you know, if it's obsessed about, it'll be obsessed about by the audience. And sort of, it's definitely true with him. And that, honestly, I can honestly say that, like, the thrill of that book was that I never did kind of get to the edge of the world like Truman in his boat. Like I was a little bit frightened that I would, and that I would sort of spend so much time thinking about these films and writing about them that I would sort of just figure out how they work and then all the magic would not be there. But I honestly was sort of still finding sort of layers to them that, and I think that sort of speaks just to the amount of time he's put into them. You know, no matter how much sort of time I sort of spent watching them, he'd spent more time making them, thinking about them. So, you know, it's sort of like you constantly think you can. It's a game of chess. You constantly think you can get a beat him at it, and then it's like, nope, he put in more time, you know.
Yeah, he'll go back and use some, yeah, and read up until the early hours to find some stratagem. What's your next project then? What have you got, something already outlined or that you can tell us about?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of at the moment, I'm sort of working on something. It's with another filmmaker, and I probably shouldn't say anything yet because it hasn't yet been signed anything, but it's another British filmmaker, and I'm sort of excited to be doing it. And it's kind of, I definitely like kind of the collaboration sort of process, because I mean, it's the one thing you definitely forget is that they generally are pretty good at collaborating. I mean, you know, most directors are control freaks, obviously, because that's the goes with the territory. But they also have to kind of collaborate. And so, and Nolan, who many people have as this kind of Kubrickian sort of chilly, you know, controlling sort of mind, you know, but he too was really good and helpful collaborator who, you know, helps open things up rather than sort of shut things down. So, you know, and he would give great notes, you know, on things. I just want to kind of so working now with somebody else, and it's sort of again, it's really exciting to sort of have that back and forth. Yeah, no, I mean, just the thing it reminds me is that they're all kind of film goers, you know, first. They all start off as film goers, and on that playing field, we're all equal, you know. So the thing that it's exciting to me is sort of finding out what films that kind of had the same effect on them that, you know, maybe theirs had on me. Just remembering that kind of filmmakers are sort of also film fans is like a kind of crucial bit of the whole equation.
Yeah, absolutely. I always think that there's not really that barricade. It's actually far more porous. And when you read someone like Paul Schrader writing about movies, you sort of think, okay, yeah, you know, it's absolutely. Which leads me on to sort of my last question, which is a question I'm thinking of asking everybody, which is, if you had to sort of like recommend one book about movies to someone who hasn't read any or whatever, what would be a book that you would think, oh, this is one you'd really have to read?
Hitchcock, Truffaut, I think. So the sort of book of interviews that Francois Truffaut did with Hitchcock just before he made The Birds, I think it was. It was sort of in the 60s. And, you know, I bought that. I mean, and I just read it till it was hanging off its hinges, you know, like it was just sort of like I read it to pieces. You know, like that book is so dog-eared, you know.
You still have the same copy.
Yeah, I do. But it's like, I mean, everybody who's picked it up knows, you know, just how amazingly easy it is to read, because it's delightfully, again, that is Q&A, but because Truffaut is who he is, it sort of totally works because they're sort of equals. And then, you know, and just in terms of like, it just covers so much ground, and, you know, you've got the great pictures and all the themes are there. And also you get like this kind of nice contrast of personalities with sort of Truffaut representing the kind of those sharp young critics from France who were sort of trying to elevate the art form and see it as art. And then you've got Hitchcock, who's kind of much more anti-intellectual and sort of treating the movies as this sort of big box of tricks where you get to play on people, you know. And so he's much more kind of like trying to explain the trick or the engine or the device, you know, and Truffaut's sort of a little bit more wanting to kind of dive into the theme and the psychoanalytic undergrowth. And it's a nice, they don't persuade each other, but they have a great sort of dialogue. And it's funny, I mean, there's definitely elements of that. I think almost any time any critic or film writer comes into contact with a filmmaker, is you're often sort of asking them to become self-conscious about something that they weren't conscious about when they made it, or they were made it in the heat of the moment and they weren't sort of thinking too hard maybe, and so all this stuff found its way into the film, but they don't know, you know. So the critic comes along and says, ah, well, you know, but what about this theme? And they can honestly be quite surprised. And it's who's right? I mean, there's no right in it, you know. Like, you know, the filmmaker can often be like a little bit surprised, and they'll want to sort of bring the kind of more intellectual take down to earth or dismiss it entirely. But the truth is that maybe they're not the best judge of like kind of what went into it, you know. And sometimes it takes somebody from the outside to kind of come along and say, you know, this found its way in, because their job in the moment was to get the thing finished, you know. Their job was not to sort of analyze the theme of it. So yeah, it's an ongoing sort of dance really between the kind of critic and the director. And I think that's why I love that book. It really just sort of sets us, I've had that dynamic, I've experienced that dynamic so many different times in different ways, you know. Like, it really is just the high watermark.
Have you ever had a big disagreement with a filmmaker that you were interviewing or collaborating with?
I mean, I definitely had, you know, there were moments with Nolan, like he definitely resisted any biographical reading of his films, you know, at all. It's very uncomfortable. He did not like doing that at all. And so I had my work cut out for me, because I did see some parallels and themes that were kind of crossing over. And I won't say it wasn't sort of so much an open disagreement, although sometimes he would say, that's, you know, I don't think that's right. But it was sort of, it was like trying to give a cat a bath. He really didn't want to go there. And, but, you know, but we ended up persuading each other very slightly of the other person's, you know, point of view. Like, he did end up persuading me that, you know, to some degree, if you look at them biographically, autobiographically, like something is diminished. And I can see that. I definitely, you know, there's a tendency to kind of play a kind of Freudian game of kind of gotcha, you know, but is the film enhanced? Is the film enhanced? So I sort of definitely came around to that. And he also then came around to seeing that there were elements in his films that he hadn't really thought about that had come from his sort of upbringing, you know, which he was kind of gracious enough to you know, concede. But he would never tell me which ones they were. He didn't want to give me that satisfaction, he said.
The ultimate puzzle. You have to work it out yourself.
I know, yeah. And he's right, you know, because it definitely made the book more, you know, for me at least, it made it more interesting because it meant that I never got the satisfaction of thinking, oh, okay, I kind of got him and tied him up with a big string, you know.
Listen, Tom, it's been absolutely brilliant talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, yeah, thanks, John. It's been a real pleasure talking to you too.
That was the first Writers on Film podcast. I really enjoyed that. It was a great conversation with Tom Schoen. I hope you enjoyed it as well. Please go out and buy his books. They're fantastic. Thanks also to Elliot Atkins for the music and Ali Harwood, who's provided us with some artwork to publicise the site. You can follow me at Dr. Jonty on Twitter, and you can visit my website, johnbleasdale.com, for more information about the podcast and my writings in general. If you have any feedback or suggestions as well, it would be great to hear from you. This is all a bit of an experiment and a learning process for me, I must admit, but I certainly have enjoyed it so far, and I hope you have too. I hope you'll join us next week for the next episode.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.